Welcome to the University of California San Francisco Sports Medicine Podcast featuring Dr. Nirav Pandya, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansdown discussing hot topics in sports medicine and society. We hope you enjoy our podcast and look forward to hearing from you.
Today on 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to talk about aging and ask the question, is aging an inevitable clock? Now, aging is something we all do, but in many ways, it has become our number one healthcare burden, both for society as well as individuals. As we age, it feels like nothing works quite as well as it should. It takes longer to recover from exercise, plane flights, jet lag, and more things break down, even when we are doing everything right. The statistics of aging are truly amazing, as our healthcare advances allow us to live much longer than we did even 10, 20, or 30 years ago. 50 years ago, we were expected to live no longer than 65. Now, the average life expectancy is 76 in the United States, but that's a skewed number because average takes into account people who pass away relatively young. A better way to think about it is that right now, two-thirds of us are going to live longer than 80 years of age, and a third of us are going to live longer than 90. For better or for worse, as our population ages, there's an increasing desire not only to live longer, your lifespan. With that comes all the wonderful abilities to continue to play sports and be active following retirement, but also an increasing burden on our healthcare system. As our population ages, there is also an increasing desire not only to live longer, your lifespan, but also to live well, your so-called health span. Along with that, there is more and more scientific information on what's really happening to our bodies as we age, as well as some really cool science on how we can potentially improve our health span as well as our lifespan as we get older. Today, we are going to talk to Andrew Brack, one of my friends and colleagues. He has truly been around the aging block despite his relatively young age. He grew up in Liverpool, England, and is an Everton fan, as is most of his family. He attended King's College, where he got his PhD, and since that time, he has collaborated with some of the best aging scientists in the world, and now has a focus on muscles, stem cells, and aging, and how we can improve our knowledge, understanding, and maybe reverse that inevitable clock. Dr. Brack is an outstanding muscle stem researcher. He's been at UCSF, but he's really been involved in academics at some of the best institutions in the world. You've been at Harvard, I believe Stanford, you've been here, and you've been involved in a company trying to develop drug therapies for aging. Can you talk a little bit about your early career, how you got interested in aging, and what sort of things you're really looking at now?
Sure. First of all, it's great to be here with you today, Brian. Depends how far you want to go back. I guess as a kid, I was always doing sports and competing in those sports. I grew up in England, and I translated that sort of sport, into an academic setting. I did my undergrad in Manchester, in England, doing human exercise science. So that's really I got to understand sort of physiology, the importance of skeletal muscle wasting. That was followed by a PhD in biophysics and molecular biology, but studying skeletal muscle. And it was in that time I started to think about aging and the molecular regulation of aging. At that point, I went to Stanford, as you mentioned, where I joined Tom Rando's lab to study the systemic effects of aging and this idea that aging is not necessarily an inevitable clock, but can be modulated by the environment. In this case, factors that are produced by different tissues in the body, secreted into the blood, and some of those factors can have positive effects and negative effects. And so my work during my postdoc there was one of the first papers that demonstrated that there was negative effects or pro-aging factors that were in the aged blood. After that work, I then started my own independent lab, first at Harvard, where we were continuing the sort of muscle wasting, muscle aging, but focusing on muscle repair and the idea that after an injury or trauma, skeletal muscle can no longer regenerate as well as it used to be able to when you're younger. And that continued, and then obviously moving to UCSF, where we met, continuing that program. To the start of COVID, I think like many people, we were sort of sitting there having existential questions. And I sort of had a serendipitous interaction with a a colleague talking about the idea of starting a company and developing drugs around repairing, fixing aging. And, you know, we looked at the work we'd done, what was in the space, and thought maybe this is a good time. There are other companies that had already sort of started this. And so we thought, why not take that dip? And that company was Arrive Bio. It was based in Singapore, but I'm in the Bay Area, but everyone was working remote. And so we thought, well, let's take the advantage of Singapore, which is great for startup businesses and very much understands the concepts of treating aging rather than treating a specific disease. We did that for 2 years. We built a platform which was allow us to develop and test, develop new drugs that would target muscle wasting. So I served as head of biology for that program. I'm still a consultant there, but as you now know, I've recently made the move back to academia at UCSF.
So you said a lot of really interesting things, but one of the things I wanted to hone in on is muscle wasting. Yeah. And we talk about muscle wasting in a variety of different settings. Is this a normal part of aging, or is this something that we see as a normal part of aging, but really doesn't have to be?
Right. Well, so I guess we're talking about what is aging, right? And in terms of most tissues of the body, they lose function, whether it's the liver, whether it's bone, muscle. So muscle wastes. And I think we can consider it part of a normal aging, but, you know, I would push back and say, I don't think it's because it's normal, we should accept it. And I think there's a lot of problem, you know, concepts out there where people talk, well, aging is normal, so we shouldn't modify it, but we should modify a disease. I have a problem with that. I think if we can prevent someone from going through those negative effects of aging, like muscle wasting, we should. So what happens during that aging process is muscle primarily loses strength and muscle mass. If we think about muscle as a mechanical unit, right, there's a muscle bundle, it's made up of fibers, and they produce force to allow movement and to prevent gravity and prevent falling if we lose balance. During that aging process, those muscles are weaker. So you can't resist those things and you fall. And that can lead to hip fractures, hospitalization, and an increase in all-cause mortality. So it's bad. How that happens at the cellular level is primarily through a miscommunication between the nerve from the brain that goes to what we call the motor unit that attaches to the muscle. That communication allows an electrical signal to fire to say contract and generate force. In the context of aging, there's a loss of those motor neurons that attach to muscles, so you lose the muscle. There's also a weakening of that firing pattern, which means you now cannot elicit that sort of force response in response to, say, losing balance. And because of that loss of signal, muscles will get smaller and weaker, leading to what we call sort of sarcopenia or age-related muscle wasting. And that is the primary sort of defect that most people will experience during day-to-day life. The other side that happens is in response to an injury or you need a surgery, right? And so when you're fixing bones, you have to go through the muscle. You will have a muscle injury that normally repairs when you're young. It doesn't when you're old. And so you find, and this is down to probably two main stem cell populations, thinking simplistically, and both of these stem cell populations lose function. And so instead of, say, repairing that muscle after a trauma or a fall, instead you'll get an increase in the amount of fibrotic tissue and fat infiltration. And that leads to an inability of that muscle to perform as it was even prior to the injury, let alone compared to how when you were youthful.
So clearly the next question is, if this is what happens, the muscle gets smaller, we can't really recover as well, what can we do to prevent it? So should we be drinking more milk? Should we be drinking stem cells, deer hooves, drink the blood of our children?
Or all of the above.
I mean, that's what I do, so.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the old adage, exercise is the best medicine. I still think exercise and strength training are really robust stimulus to maintain that muscle mass and strength. But the reality is, as humans, as a population, we're not good at adhering to exercise programs. We just don't. Or eating healthy. We don't do it. Some people can, but most larger population don't. And that's why we have an obesity, muscle wasting problem. So what else is out there? Well, clearly, to make muscle, it is formed by protein synthesis. And the amount of muscle you have is that balance of how much protein you synthesize, make, or degrade. And so it's important that people are ingesting through diet, through supplements, whey protein, et cetera, enough protein to allow that muscle to form after exercise. In absence of that, there are stem cells. You mentioned stem cells. So I think stem cells, in my sort of reading of the literature to date and what we know, I think stem cells are going to have more of a positive effect in the context of injury and trauma. That high turnover after an injury or a surgery, you need those cells to come in quickly and help either A, provide growth factors or sort of cellular scaffolds or clear infiltration. I'm less optimistic about cellular therapy for muscle wasting. There are people in the companies in the space, there are labs in the space doing this. I just don't believe you can get these rarefied cells into enough mass into a tissue to allow that muscle to grow. So I would push for cell therapy in a sort of regenerative context, but less in that steady state muscle wasting approach. There are other compounds out there. You know, we think about drugging the aging process. Medicines are there. And so talk about the most two commonly used compounds. One is metformin, which was an old diabetes drug shown to lower blood pressure. There's a sort of emerging population of people who think about aging and biological aging as a way to modify inflammation and improve metabolism of muscle through metformin. But primarily, so that's one aspect. The other side is rapamycin. So this was an old immune suppressor drug. And taking a high dose, it's very effective at suppressing, but there's a sort of interesting side effect at low dose, which seems to be that in humans, it decreases inflammation, it prevents muscle wasting, improves tissue function across many organs, and across different species, extends lifespan. And so they're sort of where people are thinking about in the space at the moment.
So you talked a little bit about exercise. How good is the evidence that exercise will help us with aging? Is it something, well, it seems to be one of those covariates where people who are exercising are eating healthy, they're drinking the right amount of coffee, they're staying away from the bad things, or is there good evidence that exercise will help us? And if so, what sort of exercises should we be doing?
So I look at it first from the point of, if you look at muscle strength is a strong predictor of all-cause mortality. So how do you maintain muscle strength? Right. And so I think, you know, strength exercise, lifting is the way to sort of move that dial. What are the most effective strength programs? Well, I'm certainly no expert bona fide in sort of the exercise physiology literature to date. But, you know, you need to be looking at movements that are multi-hinge, that involve sort of hip joints, knee joints. So your classic deadlifts, squats, things like that. And you need to be looking at low repetitions, high weights. That's going to invoke those sort of that fast nerve communication I was talking about previously. It activates the sort of molecular programs in the tissue that drive that protein synthesis that will allow that muscle to grow and maintain strength.
That's awesome. That's not entirely what I do. I just do bicep curls every day. So that seems to work.
Your tight fitting t-shirts show that.
Yeah. I mean, I do wear the adult small scrubs to the OR. especially with the, I think with the rise of social media and these fads that come and go. And I think, you know, they're not necessarily new. I remember being in the 80s where it was Diet Coke and you could put in a VHS tape and do an exercise video. But now there seems to be a new exercise or some sort of fad to keep us both healthy and aging longer. And one of the ones, because I know this dovetails some with your research, is this idea of cold immersion. And I know you've done some research in how cold can help muscle stem cells, but what is your take on this as a way to improve aging?
That's a great question. So I think, you know, many people want to embrace regimens or protocols that can delay the effects of aging. And so people are looking for this. And I think, you know, social media can take things out of hand. And of course, if it's boring and sort of mainstream, it doesn't even make news. I would start with, maybe before talking about the cold, thinking about calorie restriction. So this is another one of those sort of interventions that people can adopt. There's multiple different interventions. You can either just call it calorie restriction, you're reducing calories. There's intermittent fasting, where people think it's a kind of more trendy way of saying skip breakfast. And then there's time restricted eating. And all of these are sort of around the same intervention point, which is reducing calories can help you increase your longevity and health span. So that seems to be one that's really robust. It is conserved. It has positive effects in humans across other species. It's been reproduced in many different academic labs as well. And there are multiple different protocols out there that people are using. So I would say in the same vein as the cold immersion sort of approach that you mentioned, certainly there is a lot less data out there that to latch onto to say, oh, yes, this is clearly going to work. And what are the protocols? But what I can tell you is that the exposure to cold induces a molecular sort of response similar to caloric restriction, right? Humans have evolved and they have behavioral responses to starvation, for example, right? And you get that feed and that causes that adaptive response of in caloric restriction. The other adaptive response we have is to temperature, and we get a shivering response and our metabolism increases. So both of those interventions molecularly are sort of invoking these same survival programs. We also know athletes who will, after a hard workout or an injury, will get into ice baths. So it's already known that the acute exposure to that cold in a local sort of sense and to the tissue will decrease inflammation. And so as aging, part of aging is that sort of chronic inflammation, no surprising there'd be benefits of cold. I think what's emerging, and part of this is, I don't know if you've heard of Wim Hof, the Iceman. So he popularized the idea of it's good to get into ice cold water for minutes at a time and rejuvenates. It certainly wakens you up, right? And that's part of the response. Like the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, causes this cascade across multiple tissues and increases metabolism to generate heat. So what we've done in our lab over the last few years, we had this kind of stealth project, which I haven't spoken about, testing the effect of cold exposure on the aging process across multiple tissues in animal models. And so we're just writing this up for publication, but what we know is when we expose these aged mice to a cold exposure, these mice, both functionally and molecularly, revert back to a youthful state. So you're reversing the aging process. So you're not just delaying aging, they're becoming young again in the assays that we've analyzed to date. So we think it's robust. We see it as a sort of cross-tissue mode for rejuvenation. In terms of how could we administer that as a human, you know, you have two choices. Do you want to get in the cold or do you want to stop eating? and so, you know, neither of them are great choices. But what we're seeing sort of from human data, not in our lab, but by others, is that sort of idea of activating in a very cold shower or an ice bath for, you know, minutes at a time daily, should, I say that with caution, you know, I want to be careful, preface this, should have benefits. Now, what we don't know what a benefit looks like for aging. That gets into these issues of biomarkers. How do you know it's having benefit? Do you wait until your time of death and go, oh, I guess it worked? Or do we have biomarkers that could say, look, things at our molecular cellular tissue level look like they're moving in the right direction. I do have stronger muscles. I do feel more vital. I have improved cognitive function. And so that's where we really need, the field needs to be going next, I think, is understanding how we can measure aging.
Yeah, I think I measure it by how long it takes me from wake up to get out of the house, and I'm aging rapidly. I've also noticed that a lot of my researcher friends have an arm of their lab now as we hit our late 40s, early 50s, where they're studying aging. And I think it's all in self-preservation.
Exactly.
So taking a step back, you look at this and you say, well, exercise seems to make us feel healthy. Mm-hmm. Calorie restriction seems to make us feel healthy. And jumping in really cold water seems to make us feel healthy. Do you think it's essentially the same underlying process from an evolution standpoint? It's ramping up. It's all doing the same underlying thing that's making us overall healthy? Or do you think there is something separate about cold or one of them that's better than the other? Or should we just all live a healthy lifestyle?
Good question. I all of the things that you've mentioned that seem to have a positive effect cause a stress to our bodies, right? And you know, so I'd go with the sort of idea of this hormetic stress, that a little bit of stress in an intermittent nature is beneficial for our survival. I mean, we are adaptive species. And so I think, as all species, we've adapted to deal with these things that are all impinging on those processes. Now, of course, you can always go too far with that, whether it's chronic, and chronic stress is not good. But the absence of stress is bad. How a tissue responds to a particular stress could be common or could be distinct. So, for example, there is overlap with caloric restriction and cold exposure in terms of that metabolic process you mentioned. But there's difference with other compounds like rapamycin that are not overlapping or partially overlapping only. So there might be different ways to skin the cat, which gets you into sort of the idea of combination interventions.
I mean, it's really fascinating when you look at it in the hormonal regulation of aging, because that's kind of what you're talking about. You're talking about a little bit of stress is a great thing. And if you sat at home with gray walls and your kids' art up on the wall, it's very nice, it's peaceful, but you may age pretty quickly, but you may age even quicker if you're in a super high stress job, you're not taking care of your body, which adds even more stress, and kind of have that quintessential type A personality that's just too much, but just the right amount, especially probably with very different forms, whether it's pharmacologic, cold, excitement, exercise, not knowing necessarily when your next meal is probably going to increase our lifespan. Will that make us happier? So there's this idea of like a health span where you are kind of like an animal. You're healthy, 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 happy, happy, dead. Or the human where you're healthy and then there's a long tail kind of for me, age 49, 48 till 90, 95, where we're not very healthy, but we're still alive.
Yes. I'm not sure if alive is the metric for happy, but
depends on the day.
Exactly. Yeah, it depends what happened. I'm happy to be alive. So I think there is a health span issue, right? And I think of course, if you're doing all of these things, you are producing hormones, which will have a positive effect on your psyche. If we're thinking happiness as a psychological state, which I'm certainly nowhere near qualified to go down this rabbit hole. So thanks. So most of these things are positive in nature and will lead to happiness. And I think also being healthy, being able to play pickup sports with your friends, or being able to hang around with your kids or your grandkids, all feed into a happiness cycle, with health being at that sort of part of that. So I think they're intimately linked, but not on a day-to-day basis, but as an overall larger yearly trajectory of state.
All right. So my final question, as you and I and all of us are officially getting older, as an expert, what do you do on a daily basis to stave off the effects of aging?
None of the things I've been talking about. Okay. What do I do on a daily basis? Well, I'll tell you what I try to do in a good week. So I try to do a sort of mixed exercise program. I do enjoy these things. So that's probably why I can stick to them. I do HIIT training, which is like body weight exercise at high intensity. I'll do strength training, and I will do a zone 2 cardio sort of exercise, like a run. And I'll try and do that 3 times and some stretching work as I'm getting older, improve my mobility. So that's my sort of exercise. I do, you know, I skip breakfast. So I haven't eaten breakfast for quite a while. That's just, and I've actually found that just doesn't, and now I'm just completely sort of immune to its effects. I don't really feel hungry or anything. I take vitamin D, I take cod liver oil, and I take Acabose. Acabose is a thing that prevents the absorption of carbohydrates at the cellular level. So it sort of diminishes that carbohydrate response of that blood sugar increase and decrease. So they're the things I do. The other thing I do, which, you know, I'm not sure it's in the same zone, but growing up in England, I enjoy a good pint of beer. So, and I live in Northern California where they have a great craft beer scene. So that's also part of my routine.
I learned a ton. I'm really excited to maybe not have to jump in a cold immersion tank. I was kind of dreading it, depending on what you said. And hopefully all our listeners learned a lot about the science and some of the psychological aspects of aging. So thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Brian. Good to see you.